This is Audible.
Listening Library presents The 14th Goldfish by Jennifer L. Holm. Read for you by Georgette Perna. You cannot teach a man anything. You can only help him discover it in himself. Galileo Galilei. Chapter 1. Goldie. When I was in preschool, I had a teacher named Star Lily. She wore rainbow tie-dyed dresses and was always bringing in cookies that were made with granola and flax and had no taste. Star Lily taught us to sit still at snack time, sneeze into our elbows, and not eat the Play-Doh, which most kids seemed to think was optional. Then one day, she sent all of us home with a goldfish. She got them at 10 for a dollar at a pet store. She gave our parents a lecture before sending us off.
"The goldfish will teach your child about the cycle of life," she explained. "Goldfish don't last very long."
I took my goldfish home and named it Goldie, like every other kid in the world who thought they were being original. But it turned out that Goldie was kind of original, because Goldie didn't die. Even after all my classmates' fish had gone to the great fishbowl in the sky, Goldie was still alive. Still alive when I started kindergarten, still alive in first grade, still alive in second grade, and third and fourth. Then, finally, last year in fifth grade, I went into the kitchen one morning and saw my fish floating upside down in the bowl. My mom groaned when I told her.
"He didn't last very long," she said.
"What are you talking about?" I asked. "He lasted 7 years." She gave me a smile and said,
"Ellie, that wasn't the original Goldie. The first fish only lasted 2 weeks. When he died, I bought another one and put him in the bowl. There have been a lot of fish over the years."
"What number was this one?"
"Unlucky 13, she said with a wry look.
"They were all unlucky," I pointed out. We gave Goldie 13 a toilet bowl funeral, and I asked my mom if we could get a dog. Chapter 2. Puzzles. We live in a house that looks like a shoebox. It has 2 bedrooms and a bathroom, which has a toilet that's always getting clogged. I secretly think it's haunted by all the fish that were flushed down it. Our backyard is tiny, just a slab of concrete that barely fits a table and chairs. It's the reason my mom won't let me get a dog. She says it wouldn't be fair, that a dog needs a real yard to run around in. My babysitter Nicole walks into the kitchen, where I'm putting together a puzzle. It's kind of taken over our table.
"You've been working on that forever, Ellie," she says. "How many pieces is it?"
1,000, I say. "It's a picture of New York City, a street scene with yellow cabs. I love puzzles. I like trying to figure out how things fit together. How a curve meets a curve, and the perfect angle of a corner piece."
"I'm going to be on Broadway someday," she tells me.
Nicole has long, buttery hair and looks like she should be in a shampoo commercial. She played Juliet in the production of Romeo and Juliet that my mother directed at the local high school. My mom's a high school drama teacher, and my dad's an actor. They got divorced when I was little, but they're still friends. They're always telling me, I need to find my passion. Specifically, they like me to be passionate about theater, but I'm not. Sometimes I wonder if I was born into the wrong family. Being on stage makes me nervous. I've watched too many actors flub their lines. And I'm not a fan of working behind the scenes either. I always end up steaming costumes.
"Oh, yeah, your mom called? She's gonna be late," Nicole says.
Almost as an afterthought, she adds.
"Something to do with getting your grandfather from the police?" For a second, I think I heard wrong.
What?
I ask.
Is he okay?
She lifts her shoulders.
She didn't say, but
she said we can order a pizza.
An hour later, my belly is full of pizza, but I'm still confused.
Did my mom say anything about why Grandpa was with the police? I ask.
Nicole looks mystified.
No. Does he get in trouble a lot?
I shake my head.
I don't think so.
I mean, he's old, I say.
How old is he?
I'm not quite sure. I've never really thought about it, actually. He's always just looked old to me.
Wrinkled, gray-haired, holding a cane.
Your basic grandparent. We only see him 2 or 3 times a year, usually at a Chinese restaurant. He always orders mugu gai pan and steals packets of soy sauce to take home. I often wonder what he does with them. He doesn't live that far from us, but he and my mother don't get along very well. He's a scientist and says theater isn't a real job. He's still mad that she didn't go to Harvard like he did. A car alarm goes off in the distance.
Maybe he was in a car accident, Nicole suggests. I don't know why teenagers get a bad rap, because old people are way worse drivers.
He doesn't drive anymore.
Maybe he wandered off.
Nicole taps her head.
My neighbor had Alzheimer's. She got out all the time. The police always brought her home.
It kind of sounds like she's describing a dog. That's so sad, I say. Nicole nods.
Totally sad. The last time she ran away, she got hit by a car. How crazy is that?
I stare at her with my mouth open.
But I'm sure your grandfather is fine, she says.
Then she flips back her hair and smiles.
Hey, want to make some popcorn and watch a movie?
Chapter 3. Ring. Warm air drifts through my bedroom window. We live in the Bay Area, in the shadow of San Francisco, and late September nights can be cool. But it's hot tonight, like summer is refusing to leave. I used to love how my bedroom was decorated, but lately, I'm not so sure. The walls are covered with the painted handprints of me and my best friend, Brianna. We started doing them back in first grade and added more handprints every year. You can see my little handprints grow bigger, like a time capsule of my life. But we haven't done any yet this school year, or even this summer, because Brianna found her passion, volleyball. She's busy every second now with clinics and practices and weekend tournaments. The truth is, I'm not even sure if she's still my best friend. It's late when the garage door finally grinds open. I hear my mother talking to Nicole in the front hall, and I go to them.
Thanks for staying, she tells Nicole.
My mom looks frazzled. Her mascara is smudged beneath her eyes, her red lipstick chewed away. Her natural hair color is dirty blonde like mine, but she colors it. Right now, it's purple.
No problem, Nicole replies. Is your dad okay?
An unreadable expression crosses my mom's face.
Oh, he's fine. Thanks for asking. Do you need a ride home?
I'm good, Nicole says. By the way, Lisa, I have some exciting news.
Yes?
I got a job at the mall. Isn't that great?
I didn't know you were looking,
my mom says, confused.
Yeah, I didn't think I'd get it. It's such a big opportunity. The ear-piercing place at the mall?
When do you start?
My mom asks.
That's the hard part. They want me to start tomorrow afternoon. So, I can't watch Ellie anymore. I totally would have given you more notice, but...
I understand,
my mom says, and I can hear the strain in her voice. Nicole turns to me.
I forgot to tell you. I get a discount. Isn't that great? So come by anytime and shop.
Okay,
I say.
I better be going, she says. Good night.
Good night, my mother echoes. I stand in the doorway with my mother and watch her walk out into the night.
Did she just quit? I ask.
I'm a little in shock. My mother nods. This is turning into a banner day.
I stare out into the night to catch a last glimpse of my babysitter, but see someone else, a boy with long hair. He's standing beneath the old, dying palm tree on our front lawn. It drops big brown fronds everywhere, and my mom says it needs to come down. The boy is slender, wiry-looking. He looks 13, maybe 14. It's hard to tell with boys sometimes.
You need to put your trash out,
the boy calls to my mom. Tomorrow is trash day, and our neighbor's trash cans line the street.
Would you please come inside already? My mom tells the boy.
And when's the last time you fertilized the lawn?
He asks.
There's crabgrass.
It's late, my mom says, holding the door open impatiently. I wonder if he's one of my mom's students. Sometimes they help her haul stuff in and out of her big, battered cargo van.
You have to maintain your house if you want it to maintain its value,
he says.
Now,
the boy reluctantly picks up a large duffel bag and walks into our house. He doesn't look like the typical theater crew kid. They usually wear jeans and t-shirts, stuff that's easy to work in. This kid's wearing a rumpled, pinstripe shirt, khaki polyester pants, a tweed jacket with patches on the elbows, and leather loafers. But it's his socks that stand out the most. They're black dress socks. You don't see boys in middle school wearing those a lot. It's like he's on his way to a bar mitzvah. He stares at me with piercing eyes.
Did you make honor roll?
I'm startled, but answer anyway. We haven't gotten report cards yet. Something about the boy seems familiar. His hair is dark brown, on the shaggy side, and the ends are dyed gray. An actor from one of my mom's shows, maybe? Who are you? I ask him. He ignores me.
You need good grades if you're going to get into a competitive PhD program.
PhD program? She's 11 years old, my mother says.
You can't start too early. Speaking of which,
he says, looking pointedly at my mother's outfit.
Is that what you wear to work?
My mom likes to raid the theater wardrobe closet at school. This morning, she left the house in a floor-length black satin skirt and matching bolero jacket with a frilly white poet shirt.
Maybe you should consider buying a nice pantsuit,
he suggests.
Still stuck in the Stone Age, I see, she shoots back.
Then he turns and looks at me, taking in my tank top and boxer shorts pajama set. He says,
Why are your pajamas so short? Whatever happened to long nightgowns? Are you boy crazy like your mother was?
All the girls her age wear pajamas like that, my mom answers for me. And I wasn't boy crazy.
You must have been boy crazy to elope,
he says.
I was in love, she says through gritted teeth.
A PhD lasts a lot longer than love,
he replies.
It's not too late to go back to school. You could still get a real degree.
Something about this whole exchange tickles at my memory. It's like watching a movie I've already seen. I study the boy, the gray-tipped hair, the way he's standing so comfortably in our hall, how his right hand opens and closes as if used to grasping something by habit. But it's the heavy gold ring hanging loosely on his middle finger that draws my eye. It's a school ring, like the kind you get in college, and it looks old and worn and has a red gem in the center. I've seen that ring before, I say, and then I remember whose hand I saw it on. I look at the boy. Grandpa? I blurt out, Chapter 4 Magician.
Who are you expecting?
He asks.
The Tooth Fairy?
He seems like a 13-year-old boy, but when I look really closely, I can see hints of my grandfather. The watery blue eyes, the slightly snarky set of his mouth, the way his eyebrows meet in the middle. Is this some kind of magic? I ask. The boy curls his lips and looks at my mother.
You're raising my granddaughter to believe in magic? This is what happens when you major in drama.
He says drama like it's a bad word.
Whatever, Dad,
my mom says, sounding like a bored teenager.
This is science, plain and simple,
he says to me. But I don't see anything simple about it, and just shake my head. He gives an exasperated sigh.
It should be perfectly obvious. I engineered a way to reverse senescence through cellular regeneration.
I stare at him.
In layman's terms, I discovered a cure for aging.
His voice shakes with excitement.
In effect, I have discovered the fountain of youth.
I don't know what to believe. On the one hand, he sounds just like my grandfather. I'm half tempted to see if he has any soy sauce in the pockets of his jacket. On the other hand, I'm not totally sure I believe any of it. Part of me wonders if this is just some weirdo who stole my grandfather's ring and is tricking my mom. She's a sucker for kids with sad stories. I turn to her. Are you sure it's Grandpa? She rolls her eyes.
It's him, all right.
Of course it's me,
the boy says indignantly. He whips out an old man's worn leather wallet and shows me his driver's license. My grandfather's cranky face stares back from the photo, and the look in his eyes is exactly the same as on the boy's face. This is so cool, I whisper.
Cool? It's historic. They're going to give me a Nobel.
His voice gets louder.
Melvin Herbert Sagarsky will be a household name.
My mom yawns. She's clearly unimpressed. Or maybe just tired. It's pretty late.
I'm going to bed. Why don't you bond with your granddaughter?
She gives my grandfather a look.
And don't put anything strange in the refrigerator.
My mom tells stories of how when she was little, my grandfather would keep experiments in the refrigerator. There would be stacks of petri dishes next to the cottage cheese and butter. Then we're alone in the kitchen. My grandfather's stomach growls loudly.
Got anything to eat in this place?
He demands.
I'm starving.
There's pizza, I tell him. He stands at the counter and wolfs down the rest of the pizza.
The lab assistants live on this stuff when they run experiments at night,
he says. Then he goes to the fridge, takes out the milk, and pours himself a big glass. He drinks it and pours himself another. He waves the carton of milk at me and burps.
Make sure you take your calcium. Everything they say about bone density is true. I lost 2 inches in the last 10 years of my life.
You shrank?
The perils of old age,
he says. At least you got your hair back now, I point out.
I got back more than my hair.
His eyes glitter.
My eyes are 20/20. My hearing is perfect, and my arthritis is gone.
He wiggles his fingers. What did you get picked up by the police for? I ask.
They said I was trespassing on private property,
he says.
I got let off with a warning.
Where?
My laboratory.
His voice trembles with outrage.
I practically built that place. I have credits on 19 of their patents, you know. You'd think they'd have some respect.
I nod, even though I have no idea what a patent is.
Ever since the company brought in those fast-talking investors, everything's been different. It's all maximizing profits this and minimizing risks that, They have no respect for science.
Then he yawns. The energy seems to go out of him in a rush, like a switch flicked off, and his shoulders slump. The illusion fades, and all at once, he looks like any other tired 13-year-old boy who needs a haircut.
Where am I sleeping?
He asks. Chapter 5. Jellyfish. I'm always the first one up in the morning because I like to cook breakfast. My mom hates cooking and jokes that she doesn't know if I'm really her kid, but I feel comfortable in the kitchen. There's an order to it, and it's fun to experiment. Lately, I've been making what I call crazy mixed-up pancakes. I use a basic pancake batter and add different ingredients. So far, I've made a s'mores version, chocolate marshmallows graham cracker crumbles, a banana split version, bananas, chocolate bits, maraschino cherry, and a piña colada one, pineapples, coconut. This morning, I make an old standby, peanut butter cup. I use peanut butter morsels and chocolate chips. I'm just plating up the pancakes when my grandfather walks into the kitchen. He's wearing old man pajamas, the button-up cotton kind, and his hair is tied back with one of my ponytail holders. He must have found it in the bathroom.
Something's wrong with the toilet, he tells me. I have to use the plunger.
That happens a lot. Want some pancakes? I ask him.
Thanks,
he says, and takes a plate. He eats fast and then helps himself to seconds. Teenage boys really eat a lot, I guess. He's got a bad case of bedhead, something I'm all too familiar with. My hair's the exact same way. It's frizzy and flyaway, and I've always hated it. I wonder if I got it from him. I have a good spray that works on frizzies, I tell him. He waves his spoon at me.
I have more important things to worry about than hair. I need to get my T. melvinus out of the lab. It's what helped me sort out the mechanism for reversing senescence.
What's senescence? It sounds like a terrible disease.
Senescence is the process of aging.
I was kind of right. So, what's T. melvinus?
It stands for Pteratopsis melvinus. It's a species of jellyfish.
A jellyfish did this to you? Are you kidding me? He lifts an eyebrow.
Why is it so hard to believe? There have always been examples of regenerative abilities in nature.
There have? My grandfather leans forward, his face intent.
Take the planarian flatworm. You can slice it in two, and each part will grow into a new worm. The hydra, a freshwater creature, can actually regenerate body parts. And the sea anemone doesn't appear to experience senescence at all.
I have never heard about any of this before.
Then there's Pteratopsis nutricula.
His voice is full of wonder.
T. nutricula is a jellyfish that can actually revert its body to the polyp stage, to its younger self.
This is so interesting. He's so interesting. It's like I've never really listened to him before. And maybe I haven't. Usually when we're together, he and my mom just bicker. How do you know so much about this? I ask.
Because I've been researching it for the last 40 years. It's my side project. I've had articles published, you know.
I'm starting to think that maybe I don't know him at all. Not really. It's like he's been playing the part of grandfather in a play, but underneath the makeup is something more. A real person.
A few months ago, an Australian diver in the Philippines contacted me because he read on the internet that I was researching jellyfish. He thought he'd found an odd specimen of T. nutricula. I asked him to ship it to me. The typical T. nutricula is small, a few millimeters, the size of the nail on your pinky finger.
He holds out his pinky finger.
But the T. nutricula specimen he sent to me was huge. More than 300 millimeters!
I always
get confused about the millimeter to inches thing, I admit.
It was a foot in diameter, he explains. And there were other anomalies. I knew it was a new species. I even named it Teratopsis melvinus.
Shouldn't have been named after the guy who found it? I ask. He scoffs.
All he did was catch it. I identified it. I was the one who did all the work. I was the one who created the compound. I was the one who tested it on the mice.
You experimented on mice? That seems way worse than flushing goldfish down the toilet.
Adult mice, he says. A few days after I injected them with the compound, they reverted to an adolescent stage.
They became teenagers? I try to picture mice with pimples and long hair.
Exactly, he exclaims. So I injected it in myself, and the rest is history. I was trying to get the rest of the T. melvinus specimen out of the lab when the Renicop busted me.
I think for a moment. Couldn't you just call up your old bosses and tell them what happened? I mean, this is kind of a big breakthrough, right? I bet they'd be pretty excited.
They don't even know it's there.
His gaze hardens.
Besides, they'll just take all the credit. This is my discovery.
Good morning, campers, my mom trills. Today she's wearing one of her standard outfits, a neon purple dress that hits her above the knees and high black boots. My grandfather gasps when he sees her.
Melissa, you can't go to work in that.
What's wrong with it? My mother asks.
I can see the top of your thighs.
She waves off his concern and starts gathering her bags. Let's get moving or we're going to be late.
Late for what?
He asks. School, of course.
School?
He sputters.
I already went to school. I have 2 PhDs, in case you've forgotten.
Too bad. You're going. I called Bernadette this morning. Bernadette is the middle school secretary and one of my mother's friends. What did you tell her? I ask. She tips her head at my grandfather. That Melvin here is my distant cousin's kid. His dad died and his mom remarried a meth addict. He doesn't get along with the new stepfather, who he secretly suspects started the fire that burned down the trailer with his dad in it. So he hitchhiked up here and I took him in. That's really good, I tell her. Your dad will be pleased to hear it, she said. It's from a play he wrote in college. Hamlet in Fresno. I directed it. My grandfather interrupts us.
Why can't I just stay here? I am perfectly capable of looking after myself.
He sounds like every other teenager in the world. Did you forget that the police released you into my custody? I work with kids. I'm a teacher. I can't have a 13-year-old truant in my house. Someone will see you and I'll lose my job. There's a beat of silence as he stares at the floor.
Fine, I'll go,
he mutters. Great. Then she adds, by the way, you're Ellie's new babysitter. Chapter 6 Crispy Corn Dog. At the end of 5th grade, there was a formal graduation ceremony. Everyone got dressed up and parents came and took pictures. We even got a diploma with a ribbon around it. Afterward, my dad, my mom, her boyfriend Ben, and I went out for dinner at my favorite Mexican place, a hole in the wall where they give free refills of chips.
No offense, Ellie,
Ben said while we waited for our food.
I think it's a little ridiculous to have a graduation for elementary school.
Ben doesn't say much, but when he opens his mouth, it's always interesting. I think it's nice to celebrate their achievement, my mother said. Ben chuckled.
Getting through elementary school is hardly an achievement. Now, middle school, that's a different story.
My father grimaced.
They should give you a medal for surviving that.
At the time, I didn't understand what he meant, but I do now. Middle school is like one of those highway restrooms in the middle of nowhere. It's dirty and smelly, and it's crowded with strange people. By the time I graduated from elementary school, I knew everyone. I had watched them grow up, and they had watched me. We knew who'd wet their pants in kindergarten, and whose father always screamed too loud at the coach during t-ball games. We had no secrets, and it was comfortable. But in middle school, there are so many new kids. Some seem like they're from different planets. Like the goth kid. He's always in black. Pants, t-shirt, thick jacket, heavy Doc Martens. He has a pierced ear, eyebrow, and nose. He must set off metal detectors in the airport. Then there are the two girls who dress like twins, even though they're clearly not. They wear the exact same outfits, down to the same socks. I've heard them talk in the halls, and they finish each other's sentences. I go through the hot lunch line and look around for where to sit in the lunch court. We don't have a cafeteria. We eat outside with seagulls hovering overhead. They've been known to swoop down and grab fries off trays. The girl who's my lab partner in science has an open seat next to her. Her name's Momo, and she went to a different elementary school from me. But then I see Brianna. She's with a bunch of girls from the volleyball team. The seat across from her is free, so I slide in with my bought lunch, crispy corn dog and potato wedges with orange slices. "You cut your hair?" I say, surprised. Brianna's hair has always been long like mine. We got bangs at the same time, third grade. We even pool our money so we can buy cool ponytail holders with glittery bows and neon feathers and rainbow ribbons to share. But she won't need those now. Her hair's been chopped short in a sharp, angled bob. I'd never be able to pull off that sleek haircut. My hair's way too crazy. "It's easier for volleyball," she explains. She looks pretty, but she doesn't look like Brianna. I point to my lunch. "Look, a crispy corn dog," I tell her. She snickers. It's an inside joke. We both love corn dogs. We even made up a commercial featuring the crispy corn dog. I say my part. "You can do anything with a crispy corn dog. It slices, it dices." Brianna chimes in. "The crispy corn dog can fold up into a blanket. You can nap on it." We get more and more ridiculous. "It writes book reports. It makes dogs meow." We laugh, and it almost feels like old times. I hold out my crispy corn dog. "You want half?" She hesitates, and then gives a little shake of her bobbed head. "Coach is really on our case to eat healthy." "Do you want to sleep over Saturday night?" I ask her. She looks uncomfortable. "Tournament." "Right," I say. I remember the time I went fishing at summer camp. I didn't catch anything, no matter how many times I threw my line with the worm in the water. I listen as they talk volleyball. They think the coach is tough. Some girl named Serena needs to work on her serve. The hotel they are staying at this weekend has a pool. One of the girls stands abruptly with her tray and says, "We don't want to be late." "Late for what?" I ask Brianna. "There's a team meeting about our fundraiser," she explains. "Bake sale." "Bye," I say, but she's already gone. I stare at my corn dog and wonder if I'm the stupid worm. A tray smacks down on the table across from me.
"Can you believe this?"
my grandfather demands. He's wearing navy blue polyester pants, a button-up shirt with a tie, and a V-neck sweater with his tweed jacket. He definitely stands out fashion-wise.
$3 for a school lunch," he says. "This is a bargain?"
He polishes his corn dog off in a few bites, and then looks at my untouched lunch.
"Are you going to eat that?"
he asks. "Crispy corn dog, it makes you young again," I joke.
"What are you talking about?"
I sigh and push it over. Chapter 7. Our Town. The public bus after school is crowded, and someone's been eating too much garlic. My grandfather has been complaining the whole way home. He's not a fan of middle school. He says it's boring and a waste of time, especially gym. But it's the textbooks that have him really riled up. He waves his science book at me.
Can you believe it? Not a word! Not a footnote! Totally glossed over!
What? I ask.
Me! I should be in this book!
The bus stops, and kids shuffle off. My grandfather stares at the textbook.
How can they not mention Sigarsky?
Probably because Sigarsky is a quack,
a voice behind us says. We turn around. It's the goth kid. He only takes the bus once in a while. He usually gets a ride from an older kid in a beat-up car.
A quack? A quack?
My grandfather sputters.
Who are you?
The kid introduces himself.
Raj.
He looks at me, a long tuft of black hair flapping over his forehead. I'm Ellie, Ellie Cruz, and this is my grand... I start to say and stop myself. My cousin, Melvin. My grandfather glares at Raj.
What do you have against Sigarsky anyway?
My science teacher says it's quacks like Sigarsky that give real scientists a bad name.
Bad name? Sigarsky's a respected scientist,
my grandfather protests. Raj shrugs.
Well, my teacher says he's just another in a line of charlatans looking for the fountain of youth.
The bus brakes squeal. This is our stop, I tell my grandfather, pulling him after me. I look at Raj. Nice to meet you. He nods.
See you around.
My grandfather glowers at him as he passes.
Not if I have any say in the matter.
I cast my leads, my mother announces when she walks into the kitchen. Let's order takeout to celebrate. She goes to the drawer where we keep menus and starts rifling through them. How about Thai or Burmese? She suggests. Or there's a new Korean barbecue place I've been dying to check out.
I don't eat any of that stuff,
my grandfather says.
If you tried it, you might like it,
she cajoles him. A belligerent look crosses his face.
I don't want to try it. I like Chinese food. It's reliable. You can walk into any Chinese restaurant and know what you're getting.
All this talk of Chinese food has made me hungry. I'll take a wonton soup, I say. My mother sighs.
Fine,
she says, and a little of the excitement goes out of her voice. When my mom returns from picking up the food, we settle in on stools at the counter. My grandfather digs around in his carton suspiciously.
This doesn't look like the mugu gai pan I usually get. This looks spicy. You know I don't like spicy food, Melissa.
It's regular old mugu gai pan, Dad,
my mom says. My grandfather takes a bite, delivers the verdict.
It's not spicy, he says.
Good, my mother replies. I was really worried.
Hmm,
he says.
Did you ask for extra soy sauce?
Yes, Dad, it's in the bag,
she says, rolling her eyes at me. Well, in other news, the kids I cast as Emily and George are amazing. My grandfather's head snaps up.
You're doing Our Town? That show is a snooze.
He's right. I've seen it before and not much happens. It's basically just about these people who live in a small town called Grover's Corners. My mom likes to stage it because it has a big cast, so lots of kids can get a part. My mom starts lecturing him like he's one of her students.
Excuse me, but Our Town is quite possibly the best play ever written about the totality of the human experience.
Too bad it's so boring,
my grandfather snarks.
You have no idea what you're talking about. It's an amazing play, a hallmark of American playwriting. You just don't have any flair for drama.
My grandfather yawns widely. The phone rings and I leap up to answer it.
Bonjour,
my dad says in a hearty voice. I take the phone into the hallway. Hey, Dad, how's it going?
I'm tired of chasing Jean Valjean every night, but I'm not going to complain.
He got the part of Javert in a touring production of Les Miserables. He's been on the road since August. The play is a big break for him, but it doesn't feel the same without him around. My dad's the one who stayed home with me when I was little, so that my mom could get her teaching degree. He says trying to keep a toddler entertained was the best acting experience he's ever had. Where are you? I ask.
Iowa City.
Do they have a pool in the hotel?
Yep, indoor.
The toilet's been getting clogged up again, I tell him. My father groans.
I'll take a look at it when I swing back through.
Even though he doesn't live here, he always takes care of house things for my mom. I miss you, I say.
I miss you too,
he says. My grandfather says something loudly, and my mother shouts back. Their voices carry into the hall.
Sounds like there's company,
my dad says. Grandpa's over for dinner.
Don't tell me. You're having Chinese,
he says in a dry voice. How did you know? My father snorts over the phone.
That old man never changes.
I look back at my grandfather in the kitchen. He's slumped in the chair, his long hair brushing his shoulders, his shirt hanging on his skinny body. I don't know about that, I say. Chapter 8. The Possible. I have science first period. My teacher's name is Mr. Ham, and all the kids make fun of him behind his back by doing oinking sounds. But I kind of like him. He's funny and wears silly ties that have lobsters and cupcakes. I barely made it to class in time this morning because we were running late. My grandfather wouldn't leave until he finished printing out something from the internet. I didn't even have time to go to my locker and get my science textbook. Naturally, the first thing Mr. Ham says is,
"Please open your textbooks to page 30.
I groan. "You can share with me," Momo whispers and slides her book between us. "Thanks," I whisper back. At lunch, it's Sloppy Joe Day. No one's exactly sure what's in the Sloppy Joes, but everyone agrees that they're gross. After I get through the lunch line, I'm looking for Brianna when I hear someone shouting my name.
"Ellie! Over here!"
My grandfather is sitting at a table and waving wildly at me.
"I saved you a seat!"
He's wearing another interesting outfit today. White button-up shirt with a light blue tie, polyester khakis, and, of course, black dress socks. The quirkiest part of his outfit is the ponytail holder. It's one of mine, a bright pink one, and it kind of works on him. He taps a pile of papers in front of him.
"I'm going to show that Raj character."
That's what he's been calling him, that Raj character. "Is that what you were printing out this morning?" I ask. "What are they, anyway?"
"My articles."
"Articles?"
"I told you I've published quite a lot. I'm very well known. I have a virtual fan club in Finland, you know,"
he says. "You're famous?" His shoulders dip a little.
"It only has 231 members,"
he admits.
"But even so, they're going to go nuts when I finally announce my success with Team Elvinus. I'm going to be the next Jonas Salk."
It's like he's talking about a relative who I'm supposed to know, but have never met. "Who's Jonas Salk?" I ask. My grandfather shakes his head.
"Are you learning anything at all in this place?"
He looks past me.
"If this country spent half as much time on science education as cheering some idiot with a ball, you'd know who Jonas Salk is."
I turn to see what he's looking at and feel a stab of pain. At the edge of the lunch court, a bunch of girls are throwing a volleyball around. Brianna's with them. She spikes the ball and the girls collapse on the ground in laughter. I force myself to look away. "Tell me about Salk," I say.
Jonas Salk developed the vaccine for polio.
I'm almost afraid to ask, but I do anyway. What's polio?
Polio is a terrible disease. It left children crippled, killed them. Salk and his group of scientists pioneered a vaccine to prevent it. He even tested it on himself.
Himself? This seems nuts to me, like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Was he a mad scientist or something? My grandfather sits up straighter, stares at me, hard.
All scientists are a little bit mad, Ellie.
For a moment, I think he's kidding, but then I realize he's serious.
Average people just give up at the obstacles we face every day. Scientists fail again and again and again. Sometimes for our whole lives. But we don't give up, because we want to solve the puzzle.
I like puzzles, I say.
Yes, but have you ever tried to put a puzzle together and given up because it was too hard?
I nod.
Scientists never give up. They keep trying because they believe in the possible.
The possible?
That it's possible to create a cure for polio. That it's possible to sequence the human genome. That it's possible to find a way to reverse aging. That science can change the world.
And I get it. A palm tree sways in the breeze, its fronds brown and shedding. Something shifts inside me, like a puzzle piece snapping into place. I look at my grandfather. I think I know where Raj hangs out after school. Chapter 9. Fruit. Raj is waiting at the curb. His eyes are fixed on the cars driving up and down the street. My grandfather stomps over to him, digging in his backpack. It's my old one from elementary school. It has kittens on it. I thought it was a little uncool for him, but he told me it was a perfectly good backpack, and he didn't care what people might think.
You!
My grandfather shouts. Raj turns, watches us. His eyes flicker to me briefly before returning to my grandfather. My grandfather pulls out the papers and shoves them into Raj's hands.
Read 'em and weep,
he says. Raj scans them, then he looks up.
Most of these were published over 30 years ago.
My grandfather is stunned into a momentary silence, then says,
Einstein published a long time ago, too. Are you gonna poo-poo him?
You're being a little ridiculous,
Raj says. A compact car pulls up to the curb, a teenager behind the wheel. He has the same dark eyes as Raj, but looks a few years older. Raj folds his tall frame into the front seat.
Ridiculous, huh?
My grandfather sputters.
What do you know anyway? You're just a kid.
Raj leans out the open window, gives my grandfather a slow look.
I don't know. You're a kid, too.
He pauses.
What do you know?
When we get home, my grandfather heads straight for the kitchen.
I'm starving,
he says. I'll heat up some burritos, I say. There's probably not a more perfect combination than rice, refried beans, and cheese. He makes himself a cup of hot tea to go with his burrito. He pours the steaming water into the mug with precision, adds 2 perfect spoonfuls of sugar, and methodically stirs the sugar like he's making a formula. It makes me think of the mad scientist conversation. I liked what you talked about at lunch, I confess, about science. But how do you start? He looks up from his tea.
What do you mean?
In a puzzle. I always begin with a straight edge piece. If you wanted to cure polio or anything, where would you even start?
With your eyes, of course,
he says. Eyes? He looks at the bowl of fruit on the counter.
For example, that bowl of fruit, what do you see?
He asks. It's a battered wooden bowl. There are a few apples, a banana, some pears, and a mango. I'm pretty sure my mom got the mango on sale, because she doesn't usually buy them otherwise.
A bowl of fruit? I say.
Is the fruit alive or dead?
He probes. I look at it more closely. The apples are red and shiny, and the banana doesn't have any bruises. Alive! He picks up an apple, turning it.
Is it, though? Is it attached to a root system? Is it ingesting nutrients? Water? Those are all signs of life.
I guess not, I say. He waves the apple at me.
It actually begins dying the minute you pick it.
Then he goes to the counter and takes a knife from the butcher block. He slices into the apple, exposing a neat row of dark brown seeds.
Now,
he says, touching them with the tip of his knife.
What about these?
Dead? I guess.
This is trickier. They're dormant, waiting. Bury them in soil, give them water and sunlight, and they'll grow. In a way, they're immortal. And they were inside the apple all along.
I'm kind of blown away. I thought science was all experiments and laboratories, I admit. My grandfather shakes his head.
The most powerful tool of the scientist is observation. Galileo, the father of modern science, observed that Jupiter had moons orbiting it, proving that the Earth was not the center of everything. His observations forced people to think differently about their place in the universe.
Then he looks around and says,
But now that you've mentioned it, I am going to need a laboratory.
For what?
For analyzing the T. Melvinus when we get it back, of course.
He says, like it's obvious.
I need to replicate my results if I'm going to publish.
I think for a minute. Our house isn't exactly huge. What about the garage? I suggest. We go out to the garage, and my grandfather does a slow tour. One half is clear for my mom's car, but the other side is stacked with boxes of props from her shows over the years. There's an old workbench that was my dad's, our bikes, and a freezer. My mom likes to stock up on frozen food before she goes into production on a show. My grandfather rubs a non-existent beard on his chin.
Electricity, decent lighting. It's not climate controlled, but it could be worse. At least I'm not in the desert like Oppenheimer.
I just look at him.
Robert Oppenheimer? World War II?
We haven't gotten that far in history, I explain. We're still at ancient Greece.
Robert Oppenheimer was a brilliant physicist. He ran the Manhattan Project, which developed the atomic bomb. Oppenheimer tested the atomic bomb in the middle of a desert in New Mexico.
Wow, I say. He looks around.
Well, no time like the present. Let's get this place organized.
My grandfather wants to set up the lab around the main electricity outlets, and that means shifting all the prop boxes out of the way. It takes us the better part of 2 hours to move everything. There's a box of clip lights, and he arranges them around the workbench. The garage door suddenly rolls open, and my mother's car is there. But she can't pull into the garage because of all the boxes. She kills the engine and walks into the garage.
What are you doing? She demands.
We're setting up a lab, I tell her.
Here, in the garage?
So I can continue my research,
my grandfather explains.
Where am I supposed to park my car?
She asks. Outside? I suggest.
I don't think so,
she says. My grandfather stares at her.
You're standing in the way of scientific discovery.
I'm standing in the way of birds pooping on my car.
It takes the rest of the afternoon to put everything back. Chapter 10. Salk and Oppenheimer. I'm supposed to do a report on a famous historical figure, but instead of choosing from the likely suspects, William Shakespeare, Thomas Jefferson, Harriet Tubman, I use my computer to look up the names my grandfather's been batting around. Galileo, Jonas Salk, Robert Oppenheimer. Galileo's picture is an old oil painting, like something that should be hanging in the De Young Museum in San Francisco. He's dressed like he's in a Shakespeare play and doesn't seem like a real person. But Salk and Oppenheimer are interesting. Salk looks exactly the way you'd imagine a scientist. Glasses, white lab coat, holding test tubes. Nerdy in general. Oppenheimer is more unexpected. He's handsome, with piercing eyes. He stares broodingly into the camera like an old Hollywood actor. In one shot, he's wearing a hat and has a cigarette dangling from his mouth. I can almost imagine my dad playing his part in a movie. Also, Oppenheimer has a local connection to the Bay Area. He taught at the University of California, Berkeley. My mom is always raving about the theater program there. I can't help but notice the similarity between the two men. They were both involved in wars where science played a big part in the outcome. Jonas Salk and the war on polio. Robert Oppenheimer and World War II. Salk found a vaccine that prevented polio, and Oppenheimer helped create the bombs that were dropped on Japan and ended the war. Oppenheimer's story especially seems like a Hollywood movie. The race against the Germans to create the bomb first. And then there's the photo of one of the bombs exploding with a big mushroom cloud. There's a quote from Oppenheimer, his reaction to the successful testing of the atomic bomb. "We knew the world would not be the same. A few people laughed, a few people cried. Most people were silent." I understand how he felt. Like when my grandfather walked through the front door looking like a teenager. Science fiction becoming reality. My mom talks about how she couldn't even have imagined cell phones when she was a kid. And now everyone has them. Except me, of course. My parents say I'm too young. My grandfather comes into my bedroom without knocking. He freezes when he sees the handprints.
"Good grief! What happened to your walls?"
"They're supposed to look that way," I explain.
"That's a style? Whatever happened to a nice wallpaper?"
He points to his face. He's totally breaking out. He's got zits on his forehead and a big red one on his chin.
"Do you have any acne cream?"
"There's some in the bathroom," I tell him, and he follows me in.
"I can't believe I'm 76 years old and dealing with pimples again,"
he grumbles. I dig through a drawer, find a tube, and hand it to him. He smears some cream on his zits.
"Maybe next time I'll find a cure for acne," he says.
We order Chinese takeout again for dinner. My mom wanted to order sushi, but my grandfather said the person who has the most degrees should get to choose. Since he has 2 PhDs, he won. As we eat, I find myself observing my grandfather and mother like I'm a scientist, an Ellie version of Galileo. For one thing, our whole seating arrangement is different. When it's just my mom and me, we sit next to each other. But my grandfather sits at the head of the counter like he's the king. Then there's the way they talk to each other, or rather, don't talk to each other. My grandfather grills my mom with questions I can tell she finds annoying. Does she still have her college transcripts? Would she like to meet with a friend of his in the Stanford biology department to talk about the program? Would she like his help in applying? She answers him the first few times, but after a while she stops and just looks at her plate the way a teenager would. I have a sudden realization. Even though my mom's a grown-up with her own life, my grandfather still treats her like a kid. After we finish dinner, I pass out the fortune cookies. My grandfather doesn't look very happy when he reads his fortune. "What does yours say?" I ask him.
"You are going to have some new clothes,"
he says. "Not a bad idea, Dad. Maybe we could get you some clothes with a little style. You look like you shop in the old man department." "I can drive you to the mall," my mom offers.
"There's nothing wrong with my clothes. They're brand new. I just bought them a few weeks ago after I turned young."
To me, he says,
I had to, because I shrank.
Then he turns to my mother.